WFIU.
Wesley first and then George.
Well, I have a little problem with it. The Federal Philippine Universe then what has changed is the scale of your ruler. So those photon fields in the universe then and now, if you look at them, from, let's say, matter has cooled and contracted, right? We may say it this way. The Hubble constant tells us that a 1 meter rod of our little corner of the universe is constructing at the rate of approximately around 6.8 nanometers per century, and has been for millions of years. So relative to the time when the universe becomes transparent, photons haven't changed at all. Now what you're telling is changing the energy of the photon. Enter again.
I'm telling you that the photon's frequency is lower. It started as the light of a close to an incandescent light bulb, and it's now just a microwave hum in your old CRT television. That bit of that snow in the background, about 1%, is the cosmic microwave background showing itself.
What you're saying is if the energy changed to lower, it tells about the change of the energy level. But the change of energy level could be seen from the speed of the photon as well. Enter here.
Yeah, but ultimately, you have to balance the equation. So if you have some kind of energy equivalent for the inflation, which you don't, then that velocity going away from you is equal to the amount of apparent energy loss of the photons that are redshifted. But you don't have that. So that's where the big problem began, that they couldn't balance the book.
It is redshifted as it rises in gravitational potential energy against the rest of mass energy of the universe. I can agree with that.
Okay, and like I said, there are physicists who believe in that variation because they really like to balance their books. And the idea of major conservation laws having ways of getting around them and extremes gives them agita. So, it's a perfectly acceptable theory. It's one way of looking at it. It's not the way all physicists look at it. I will include an article from Sean Carroll, a noted physicist, discussing this problem with the conservation law of energy not being absolute, but you're free to believe that it's a potential gravitational energy.
The only problem is that you can observe redshifted, which did observe the same energy, but only over the longer time scale. And to exceed.
I mean, that's sort of the point. The point is that these are phenomena that occur over a very long time span, because time doesn't vary that much in small packages. Unfortunately, though, in large billions of years, relativity catches up, and time itself is not stable. The problem with relativity, or the benefit, or whatever you want to call it, relativity, is we learn that space and time are not reference points. There's no standard. There's frame of reference that's better than any other. It's all subject to interpretation based on your frame of reference.
Thank you very much. Finally, I got close to it. But I was trying. Enter Xia.
I think the journey is more important than the destination, because I think we learn more from it, personally. George, you wanted to say something before we close this up for tonight?
82FIU, I think the measure of 13.8 billion years approximately, give or take billions of years or whatever, is telling me something that we understand something else has occurred. And I'm not sure what that is. So I'm not saying that we're going to answer that here or even get any more perspective here. But the balance of it is that nothing began. As what's been laid in my mind all my life is that it's all a transfer of energy. It speeds up, it slows down. And it's all relative to the size of masses and particles around it. When you said 13.8 billion and you gave a... That wasn't definite. I know you meant it, did not mean it to be definite. However, what caused before that? And where does it go after that? So all of the calculations that we have right now are not really going to be answering this. They're really not going to be bringing to understanding, except it speeds up, it slows down.
I'm sorry, I have a problem. What is the mechanism of speeding up and slowing down? And you mentioned also contraction.
Correct. Where did the energy come from?
No, I ask you the question. Would you please be kind enough and give me the answer? Don't ask the question again.
Wesley, think of it. For it to go forward, where did it come from?
Dr. Roy?
I'm not making this argument. George is making this argument. I think maybe we should table it for tonight because I really don't want to take any more space time away from Paul and his space report. I just want to thank everyone who participated. And maybe someday we go into what happened before the Big Bang. There's a lot of theories. There's no definitive theory for any of that. You know, some people think that time didn't exist before the Big Bang, whatever that means. Other people believe in the hyper universe of hyperdimensional many universes bouncing back and forth and hitting each other and causing some energy transfer and all kinds of fun stuff. But we'll get to that some other night. I just want to thank everyone who participated tonight, and I had fun, and I hope the people who participated, the people listening had fun. And I just want to again remind everyone that to suggest any topics, if you have any questions, if you have any mailbag questions, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com, and I am going to post a couple of links for you to look at roy.ac2gs.com. Once again, thanks to everyone, and I'll be back next week to try and do this all over again.
Thank you, Roy.
Thank you, Roy. One last comment I've got, Roy. You said in sometimes we're talking about photons, and I was talking about mechanical speeding up and slowing down in temperature. That photon had to come from somewhere. Doesn't the photon usually come from something moving very fast that's very hot to create that photon? Over to you on that one last, Roy.
Well, I mean, in the case of most of the cosmic microwave, it's a primordial photon. It existed, when the universe was very, very young, and everything was very, very high energy. Particles and antiparticles were annihilating each other and recollecting and annihilating. And there seems to be some asymmetry in matter and antimatter, so that for every billion matter and antimatter pairs, somehow you get a just one matter pair. So when finally the temperature went down a little bit, you were left with these billion photons for every single one of these positive matter particles. And that's what we're really alluding to. This is kind of goes before the concept of atoms bouncing up against each other and emitting photons. Because they were just a field of quarks and leptons back in those days.
Okay. Well, we have a lot of participation tonight. Paul, WS2N. What's space doing these days? You got it, Paul. KQLIW in the tech end.
Okay, very good. Very good, Roy and Dick. There's plenty of things going on in the space world. This is WS2N for the Space Net Report for TechNet. And not only last week, but of course next week. You know, I mean, right off the bat, this Wednesday, you can watch on NASA TV the launch of a Progress Soyuz rocket going up to the International Space Station from Kazakhstan at 8:10 in the morning. You know, so if you're off and you're having coffee, you could put that on the NASA channel and see how they do with that. They're improving the Progress system. Better Soyuz rocket. They finally have gotten away from analog systems to digital systems. And they've been using these rockets, you know, for decades, and they've made different iteration improvements over the years. And there's another one that is going into this one, as well as the manned launches. But they send up probably 3-4 of them per year to the space station. But the main topic was last week, a few days ago, another SpaceX story. Let me drop it. SpaceX has a goal of building a starship, actually called the Starship, to eventually be launched to the moon and eventually to Mars. And in fact, he plans on someday maybe even using them to go from, you know, one part of the Earth to another, you know, quick transportation for, you know, for maybe 40 or 50 people that want to get in this thing at a time. So he's in the process of developing that. But to do that, he needs to test the new engines that he has. They're called Raptor engines. He's got to be able to see if these things work. He wants a similar system to what's been going on for years now with the Falcon 9 rockets. His goal is reusability, and he's very successful with the Falcon 9 system. But now he's developing the Starship. So he needs this test piece of equipment called the Star Hopper. Now, this one will never go into space, but let me drop it. But he's completed building it. It's a test vehicle. Down in Texas, a place called Boca Chica, Texas, and it's a large vehicle. It's 65 feet tall and 31 feet in diameter, and eventually he plans on putting multiple engines on the bottom of this thing. For now, he just wants to put one engine down. He's just getting his feet wet with the new engine that he's developed, the Raptor engine. Raptor engine delivers about twice the amount of thrust than the old Merlin C engine that he's using now for the Falcon 9. So over the last, I'd say, few months or so, he's tried a couple of different engines and sent them back to Texas to look at them after he lit them off. The vehicle didn't go anywhere. It was tethered down in the past. The most it's gone up was like a couple of inches. Sent that Raptor engine back to investigate it and see how it's doing. And he got another Raptor engine delivered to Texas. It's the sixth one that's been developed. And he installed it at the bottom of this lodge. Looks like a big water tank. In fact, it's being built by people that build water tanks. Big stainless steel. If you look at it real quick, you think it's in a gigantic silver garbage can, about 31 feet in diameter, four large landing legs off of it, and one big engine in the middle. Well, he lit it off the other day and untethered, and this thing got 65 feet in the air. Now this thing's about 65 feet tall, so it went about the same height as the vehicle itself. And that was his plan, to get up around 60 feet. And he wanted to translate. He wanted to go over about 100 feet. And it worked. And, you know, 100% he was successful. And that's just the start for this Star Hopper, they call it. His next goal is within a couple of weeks. He thinks around 2 weeks or so. He's going to do it again. Again, probably with just one engine. And he wants to get up to around 600 feet, roughly 10 times higher. and come back and land in the same place it took off from. And his goal is to eventually increase that height to maybe 9 miles high as time goes on. But this is a start for him. Been developing it for many years, the Raptor engine as well as the Starship. In Boca Chica and in Florida now, he's actually building the top stage called the Starship. Of course, that looks more like a rocket. It's going to have the same diameter as this test vehicle, the Starhopper, but it's also going to have this big pointy thing on top. Eventually, that's where a crew would go and passengers. When completed, the Starship itself would have about 7 engines in it, 7 of these Raptor engines. That whole setup would be able to actually launch from Earth and go into orbit. And the idea is to bring this whole thing back. It's one stage to orbit, one stage back. And the idea is to eventually bring it back and land safely on the ground, landing the same way with the engines. So that's the ultimate goal for a Starship. Now that's only, that can only get them to orbit. His next goal is to make the Heavy.
Is it true that he's made for 100 people?
He started off with that way, now it's down to 40 people, They cut back on that, Wesley. He's got 2 of these Starships being built, one that down, nearby this test vehicle, the Starhopper. And then he's got another one being constructed in Florida, not too far from where they launch these things. So hopefully over time he'll be able to do this. When it gets up to maximum thrust, this engine would have 440,000 pounds of thrust. It's a little bit better than twice the amount of the existing Merlin C engines for the Falcon 9. He wants to take the Starship and eventually get it to the Moon or to Mars. Now, to do that, he needs to put this thing into orbit, but with a booster behind it, and this booster is going to be really large, like 250 feet, and that one will have around 31, I've heard different numbers, 35, but now 31 engines, same thing, the Raptor engines, to boost this whole setup to orbit, and now that Starship, of course, would be completely fueled, and you'd be able to take that. That would be like the equivalent of the second stage, and you'd be able to go to the Moon, land on the Moon, come back from the Moon. That's his goal. And again, land vertical back, took off from, probably in Florida. It's all liquid methane. Chilled down to extremely low temperature. It's going to be the liquid oxygen. And even the engine itself doesn't waste any power. Most engines have like an exhaust coming out. They'll send some of the fuel through a pre-burner, and that will spin a turbine, and the turbine will spin the fuel pumps and the oxidizing pumps. In this case, he's got 2 separate pre-burners, one to control the fuel and one to control the oxygen. And then the fuel from that, the exhaust from that is actually pumped back into the main combustion chamber where all the real action takes place. So it's the first time this type of engine has been successfully flown, actually. I think they call it a full flow stage combustion engine. It's been a dream to build this thing, and really nobody's been able to successfully do this. He has. The Russians tried it with back in the 70s, but then they stopped that program. this guy's doing it, and he, as far as reusability, he'll probably eventually wind up doing the same thing he's doing with the Falcon 9. So before I go on, any questions about the Starhopper successful flight a couple of days ago? It's WS-12. Okay. One sad note, Chris Pratt, he was flight director for all the tail end of the Mercury programs, the Gemini programs, Apollo, and even into he did Skylab and Soyuz, and he got involved with the earlier flights of the space shuttle, and he passed away last week. He was in, mid-90s or something like that. But without him, I mean, this guy, he set up the whole thing down in Texas with Mission Control. He devised that whole setup, how everything was going to work. Flight control was the main guy, and all these other groups all the way down the line. When they call out, all the different people to find out if they're ready to go. He's the one that developed that system. They go down one right after the other, go, until they eventually get the flight. And he thinks everything's okay, he'll say go. So, but he died, and I know they've already named a building of, after him, when he's alive. So there might be a few more buildings named after this guy after, I wouldn't be surprised. Let me drop it. Now, SpaceX, of course, my favorite topic to talk about, because they have the most rockets going up. They just launched on Wednesday. They launched the Dragon cargo vehicle up to the International Space Station. Brought about a little over 5,000 pounds worth of stuff. They brought an extra EVA suit, space suit up there. Got all kinds of supplies for the crew itself. And in the back of the trunk, they call it the trunk. That's an unpressurized area. They bring a lot of things up. They'll bring satellites up. They'll bring things that are permanently attached to the International Space Station. That's how they would beam up the Bigelow expandable activity module, which is still attached to the station. Well, they're bringing up an adapter that's going to be attached to the International Space Station. And they call it IDER, International Docking Adapter, number 3. There were originally supposed to be 2 of these things attached to the space station. They have 2 locations where you could dock, and not berth, but dock crewed vehicles to the space station. They would attach normally to the pressure mating adapter 1, pressure mating adapter 2, and pressure mating adapter 3. One is permanently used for another purpose, but those 2 adapters, they're the ones that you would see. They would offset, connection piece, offset by about 22 degrees, and you would see the shuttle attached to it, and that's how they always docked. Well, time has gone on. They have better docking systems, but they needed a new adapter to connect to the space station. So they made up this adapter to connect to both pressure mating adapter 2 and pressure mating adapter 3. Number 2 has been completely installed. That's already up there, and in fact, it's been used once so far. It was used by the Dragon crew vehicle that went up last March. I was uncrewed, but that was a test of the first crew vehicle to go up, and that was very successful. I went there and came back and landed back in the ocean. The story of the IDERs started to bring up IDER number 1, and that was a few years back, and it was then encapsulated in the Dragon vehicle just like Wednesday. But when this one went up, it got up to about 7 or 8 miles, and the whole thing blew up. And that was a problem with one of the struts inside the vehicle. You know, over time they figured out what it was, and the strut broke loose and released this helium bottle, which is extremely high pressure. And the helium line broke, and it instantly pressurized the oxygen tank, and one thing led to another, and the whole thing blew up. So that's what happened with that one, and that took out that first ITER, International Docking Adapter Number 1, was gone, built by Boeing. It weighs as much as a CRV, this thing. A regular car, probably about 3,500 pounds, but built by Boeing, and that adapter was history. So they were working on number two. They always had plans on having two. So number two eventually made it up there, and they had spare parts that they never used and built some new parts for number three. So now when you go up with a Dragon spacecraft, or eventually a Boeing spacecraft called the Starliner, and it's going to be launched with a crew very shortly, so they'll have a place to dock, and even the future Dream Chaser. But any vehicle that plans on docking with the space station that's going to have a crew in it will have to dock to these two ports. Many ports all over the space station, but actually, most of them are already filled right now. But let me drop it before I go on. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report. Any questions? Well, okay. Another launch that went up to the space station again, SpaceX last week, or actually the week before. I think it was probably Sunday or so. They took up a crew to the space station. Russian, of course. Wait, correction. This is a launch by Russia on a Soyuz rocket. Took the crew up to the International Space Station. And they took up one Russian, one American, and one Italian. I spoke about this last week. From Italy, one guy's from the States. In fact, the guy from the States is a doctor. He was an emergency doctor for the Army for quite a few years. And it's always good to have a doctor up there. But he's got his first name, Morgan. He went up with Luca Palmento. He's from Italy. He's been up before. But that was a successful mission. From Kazakhstan. So it took them only four orbits, which is one of the goals of the new rockets that Russia is using. They've shortened that trip. It used to take a couple of days, and now they're down to four orbits. So roughly 6 hours after launch, they were able to dock with the International Space Station. And they dock on the Russian side. So the Russian side has four different possible ports you could dock with. And on the U.S. side, you have four different ports as well. We have two for crew, two for cargo. And we have a better setup because the cargo, we have a much bigger door. Crew version, you can only go through about a meter in diameter. With the cargo version, you can bring in, 50, 60-inch wide things through this big garage door, it looks like, when they open it up. So we have this better capability than the Russians. So we're going to have both. We're going to have the instant docking capability, and we're going to have the ability for two cargo setup that can go to the space station. That gives you eight different locations to dock. stuff to the space station. So that's pretty good. SpaceX wanted what they did last a couple of months ago. They launched the Falcon 9 Heavy, and that was very successful for the mainly for the Air Force. It was like 27 satellites on board. But one of the satellites was a light sail. Not light, I mean light from they're going to use light from the sun to push this satellite through the around the orbit. It's called Light Sail 2. It was financed by the Planetary Society. They got enough money together from donations to put this CubeSat, a good sized CubeSat, but about the size of a big toaster. And that was one of the satellites out of 27 that was released. And just last week they opened it up, and sure enough, that worked. It's around a little over 300 square feet, 340 square feet size. So it's a big Mylar-looking silvery thing, a big square opened up, and now the sun is starting to push this and accelerate it. They want to see how it's going to work. Eventually, they'll get it to a higher and higher orbit. And the Planetary Society has plans of building Light Sail 3, which will actually, be a part of a mission. They plan on sending it out to an outer planet. But naturally, that's in development. They want to see how this one works out. Last one didn't go too good. Light Sail 1, that was launched by a Russian rocket, and the Russians had a problem with their rocket, and I think never was tested. But Light Sail 2 is now working, and this one is bigger than Light Sail 1. So that's good news. And then there's one other rocket that went up recently. On that same launch, that space launch, SpaceX launch of the Heavy. There were 27 satellites, but one of the main satellites was this big, long, big, heavy satellite. And it's called the Air Force Research Laboratory Demonstration and Science Experiment. And the idea is to test radio waves going through the ionosphere. But it's an interesting piece because it's when it opened up, finally you got a chance to open it up this week. That's why I'm talking about it now instead of a month or so ago when it got launched. It's what they consider the biggest satellite that is unmanned ever put into space. It's got these struts, these pieces that move out, a bunch of truss pieces. That move out to around, I think, around 240 feet, or almost the size of a football field. And then that has antennas on it, and long wire type antennas. And they're going to be transmitting very low frequencies. I think I haven't gotten the frequency yet, but it's supposed to be very low frequencies, and they want to see how the ionosphere affects the signal. But interesting to see that this thing is so massive. I always think of the satellites just going up there, and most of them, maybe some big, 10 or 15 meter dishes or something, which we have up there. Some of them are like 80 or 90 feet diameter, but this thing is like almost 250 feet long. So that was another successful satellite that was put up. They put them up, and sometimes they have to wait a month or two before they put these things into operation. So they get basically there's 280 meter booms. I think one's going one way and the other one's going the other way. Still haven't gotten a picture of this contraption yet, but it should be interesting to see. I'm sure eventually maybe that'll come out, but maybe because it's military, maybe it won't. But we'll have to search for that. Any comments or questions for the space portion of the TechNet? This is WS2M. Okay, now China has a flight that just went up, and it's by a private company called iSpace. They've tried before, and they finally succeeded. It's a solid booster rocket. They did launch a satellite, you know, and launched from the Gobi Desert. And this is China's idea of, I guess, starting to compete with the private companies in the States. So their goal is to go after the smaller, lower payload satellites. From what I understand, this was supposed to be an amateur radio satellite as well, but we haven't got the frequencies yet, or how long it's going to be up there. Sometimes they, some of these things lately go up for a couple of weeks and they start to decrease. And my guess is that's probably what's going to happen here. Some of them are just beacons. I don't know if this one you're going to be able to communicate with, but they're on the same trip that we are with private companies now. They're now getting involved. They have at least three companies in China that are trying to do this. They're the first ones to achieve orbit. So let's deal with that. Space mission that's doing good is the India moon launch that was launched a little over a week ago, and that's the Chandrayaan 2 satellite. Apparently, Havana, that means moon vehicle, in Sanskrit. Sorry, I did read that somewhere. And its goal is to put it into a 62-mile orbit around the moon, and then from there, on the front of it, they've got this lander. Legs are already sticking out. They hope to land on the south side of the moon, and then they have a rover that's going to come out as well after it lands. They think the rover and the lander will probably just last a couple of weeks during the daylight of the moon. They don't think it's going to survive the night. I don't think they put any RTGs on there, radioisotope, thermoelectric generators, or even plutonium to keep the circuits warm. I think they just plan on, they're going to be happy if they get this thing to work for 2 weeks. This is their second trip to the moon. India has launched an orbital spacecraft back in 2009. Here we are about 10 years later. And they finally got this thing off the ground. They work on a contract with Russia, but they have Russia had some problems, so they're going to have a deal with them. They were going to build half of it. And India said, we'll do the whole thing. And we'll launch it on our own rocket. And they did it. It worked. And it should land September 6th. That's the date. Right now it's in a highly go orbit around the Earth. And each time it goes around, it's going to ignite its rocket a little bit more. And it will get further and further out until eventually it gets caught up by the gravity well of the moon. And it'll get sucked in and put into orbit. From there, they'll try a landing sequence. So the orbiter will stay active for at least 1 year. My guess, they'll probably get more out of that with the lander and the rover only a couple of weeks. But India is doing good right now. They have a spacecraft going around Mars. They launched a few years ago, and that's doing good. And they have a planned manned missions in the future. They're developing a capsule. They've already tested their version of a capsule and launched it into space. Wanted to see what it was going to be like when it came through the atmosphere and that type of thing. So that's pretty much all I have. Any comments or questions for the space portion of the net? This is WS2N.
Paul, thank you. KD2FIU, this is George. And I think we need more involvement as the U.S., and thank you for reporting it with the description that you have and the accuracy that you have reported it. But it scares me that we don't have more as we did. And just looking back, of course, we're looking at the 50-year-ago thing that we were in totally on top of the world with this, on top of the moon with it. Thank you, Paul. KD2FIU.
KD2FIU. Okay, thanks for that too, George. And yes, well, yeah, there's a lot of things in development. Within another year or two, you'll see another big booster being launched from Cape Canaveral Launch Complex 36 has been taken over by Jeff Bezos of Amazon. He's got a company called Blue Origin, and they're in development of a massive rocket almost as big as the Saturn V. He's got, it's called the New Glenn. He's also got suborbital flights planned later this year or maybe early next year with the new Shepard. That'll be out in Texas. You have, a lot of American companies, Firefly, Vector. You've got, a couple of them that are developing small launch vehicles for all the small satellites, the thousands of satellites that they plan on launching, communications. And, of course, we can't forget NASA, still developing the Orion spacecraft with the SLS, the Space Launch System. They'll be doing a test on the four engines that are going to be attached to the Space Launch System probably early next year. And then within, beginning of 2021, they'll probably be able to launch that rocket. And the goal is to launch that thing around the moon. It's a, crewed vehicle without a crew. And they plan on doing that and then bringing it back safely. And if all goes well the following year, they would be launching a four-person crew all the way to the moon and probably do the same thing, orbit the moon. Maybe drop off the first piece of a new space station that will be, going around the moon. So we're doing a lot. We have the private companies that will be going up to the space station bringing crews. We won't need Russia anymore. If all goes well, you should have Boeing and SpaceX doing that. They hope the first crew would go by the end of the year, but I'm going to guess probably the beginning of next year. If things go right for both companies, you should be able to see a lot of American launches. Private companies will be launching not only cargo, but crew to the International Space Station. Orion, and within a couple of years, will be launching to the probably to the moon with a Space Launch System. And by the way, that thing's a lot bigger than the old Saturn V. Saturn V was 7.5 million pounds of thrust. The Space Launch System by NASA is going to be 8.8 million pounds of thrust. So that'll be a big deal in a couple of years. Still all under development. And then you've got companies like SpaceX building the Starship. Hopefully they, don't have too many problems and they can get that thing into orbit and eventually around the moon and someday to Mars. And now that's a complete reusable system. That whole big booster will come back and land just like Falcon 9 does now. Falcon 9 booster comes back and lands. They reuse them. I talked about the cargo that just went up to the International Space Station. That vehicle that docked with it, that Dragon cargo vehicle, that's the third time that thing has been launched. They've launched many times. They'll send a vehicle up and then they'll send another one up. But this is the first time they've gotten to be able to do it three times. So it's three times for that. The boosters are all being reused. They've successfully brought back 44 boosters over the last few years. They've dropped the cost tremendously. Everybody's now trying to compete against SpaceX worldwide, too. So there's a lot of developments in different groups. The European Space Agency wants to have a reusable engines, at least. Boeing wants to do that with the Atlas V. So there's no end. I think the next couple of years, or three or four or five years, should be very interesting for the space program here in the United States, especially. And, of course, the world is going to keep going. If we don't, they will. Any other comments or questions?
Are we hearing any of the specifics of the next moon landing, Paul? I think it's going to be to the South Pole. And in order to have energy to maintain the operation, are they going to be setting up solar cells on the top of a mountain on the South Pole on a rotating system so that it always looks at the sun, and somehow that energy gets down to where the real operation is taking place, where they're digging into the bottom of a crater at the South Pole in order to mine that water. That in theory, if you add energy to it, you can break the water into oxygen and hydrogen, and it becomes a fuel. And is there going to be habitation there? You would think if we're really going to the moon's South Pole, you would start seeing some articles as to the details of how they're going to maintain manned operation there for any length of time. I don't think we've been seeing any articles about what's going to take place and what's the real motivation other than discovering that there's water that can be used. So I'm having trouble believing what's the main motivation for going to the moon other than to prove that there really is water there. WS2N, K2IW.
KD2FIU, subsequent question.
4 years ago, they had plans of putting eventually a space station around the moon called Gateway. And that's still a plan. They plan on landing on the moon probably 2028, the earliest, and eventually trying to stay on the moon. Then all of a sudden, now this administration thinks that they can push everything up 4 years, and the problem is they don't have the money to do that. They said that this is what they want to do, so they want to do it by 2024. They don't have the money, and they're not going to get the money. So, unfortunately, we're going to be stuck, as far as the United States is concerned, I think 2028, unless they magically come up with another $20 billion. Real quick, NASA needs around $20 billion per year to do everything that they're doing. I mean, just the space station alone is around $4 or $5 billion to keep that going per year. Then they have all these other projects and things that they're involved with, all these other launches, science missions. They don't want to cut anything like that, so they need more money. And how much money they need? Minimum estimate that is another $20 billion for the next 3 or 4 years. So unless something magical happens, I don't think that's going to happen. You got more of a chance of a private company like Elon Musk, or even Blue Origin. He has not only the rocket that he's building right now, he's got the whole building stuff right now in Expedition Park, just outside of where they launched the rockets. He's got people in there working on the New Glenn rocket. He's also got designs and plans on building something called Blue Moon. Blue Moon is going to be the lander that's going to land on the moon, originally with cargo and stuff, and eventually people. So, again, the long-term goal is to try to work the resources of the moon, get the water out, hydrogen, oxygen, fuel, breathing. Let me drop it. And then what's the ultimate goal? I'll tell you.
Yeah, before we run out of time, George, KD2FIU, had a question that should be added. Go ahead, George.
Just look. looking back on what they had done earlier, and of course they'd know better where to land at this time. And what I'm looking at is, why weren't we not involved more? And of course, Paul, you can answer that. But the concept of the U.S. not being involved is really bothering me, and I don't get it. The thing I wanted to make clear was is that what I learned from the last landings that the U.S. had done in 69 through the early 70s was you got to be prepared for in the sun plus 250 Fahrenheit and in the cold minus 250 Fahrenheit. Are the people ready for that?
Well, you don't have that much extreme at the South Pole, if I understand, correctly. Back to you, Paul.
Yeah, you're right, Dick. And, they're planning on it. Don't forget, this is years in the future, but they've already got equipment that they're testing right now called the Kilo fission reactors. They have these 10 kilowatt systems that are going to be run off. It's just essentially a fission operating system, and they're going to be able to put, you know, three or four of these down on the ground, and then run cables out, and that's how they're going to power their habitats early on. And they said that they tried everything to break these things out in the Nevada desert, and they couldn't break it. They're breaking pipes, they're breaking everything, and everything just kept working. So it's supposed to be a pretty durable system. So that's with solar panels and you name it, fuel cell technology. You mix the hydrogen and the oxygen that you can dig out of the ground, and you can actually create electricity and then eventually water from that process as well. So they got long-term plans, but you know, don't hold your breath. But I think it's going to happen. Too many other countries are involved. Let me drop it. India wants to go to the moon. China wants to go to the moon. And, Russia, but they're a long way off. They're probably definitely into the 2030s. But, you know, we don't want to be sitting here watching all the other countries walk around on the moon and we're just doing the space station. You know, we can't have that. And we're out of time. Back to you, Dick, WS2N.
What's the real long-term goal, though, for going to the moon? Other than proving that there's water there, I can't believe we're going to colonize it. I can't believe anybody wants to stay there and live there, Paul. So has anyone answered a real good long-term poll? Long-term goal?
Fuel and be able to launch from the moon to Mars and to the outer planets. You know, 1/6 gravity is better than, you know, better than Earth. I mean, that's the ultimate goal there.
Wouldn't we better launching from that gateway? Okay, thank you, Paul. Roy, want to re-announce your addresses? AC2GS, K2LIW.
Yeah, certainly, Dick. I always take that option. Once again, if you have any mailbag questions for Dick, if you have any topics you would like me to cover, if you want to volunteer a puzzle, I could always use a puzzle. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag at, my call sign is AlphaCharlie2GulfSierra.com. And if you want to take a look at the three-dimensional plotted images of antenna radiation and links to Veritasium and links to an article about how energy really isn't conserved after all, it's there on roy.ac2gs.com. And once again, thanks for the opportunity to be here and do what I do. Have a good week, guys.
You guys are well appreciated. And we're getting some very nice mail. I mailed each of you guys. What?
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73. And good night from the W2VL repeater.
Good thank you, guys. K2RIW clear.
Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. That's tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. That's tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. That's tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. That's tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 o'clock a.m. This is the W2VL repeater. That's tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.
Very sticky this morning.
Tonight. tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.